Morning, Your Honors. My name is Matthew Weinberg, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Catherine Lawson. We're here today on Ms. Lawson's appeal of the Circuit Court's decision to terminate spousal support. This case originally oriented in Juvenile Domestic Relations Court back in June 2015, where that court terminated spousal support and Ms. Lawson appealed. At the hearing, Ms. Lawson elected, wise or not, to represent herself, so she showed up pro se. Ms. Lawson, I will say, is very, very intelligent. She's smart. She tried to research the best she could to argue her point. Her point that she really had to...
How do you get past procedural default in this case?
Well, to jump right to the case, Your Honor, I think there's two separate reasons. I think on its face, she raised the issue that we're arguing today. I think if the court doesn't want to go that far... to acknowledge that there's absolutely good cause. So I'll start with the first. And the first would be, did she raise it?
Good and I cause think means that she didn't have an opportunity to raise it, right?
Correct, Your Honor. So with regards to the first time she raised it was, if you look at the appendix, page 99, Mr. Pincus, who's representing Mr. Lawson, he informs the court that he does not believe statute 20-101A is applicable to Ms. Lawson's defense because it's a contractual agreement between the parties. So the judge hears his argument, and then the judge turns to Ms. Lawson and he says, well, Mr. Pincus's position is that the statute you refer does not apply under these circumstances because of the express language in the agreement. Ms. Lawson then immediately responds, well, as far as the express language, it also said he had to pay a certain amount every month. At that point, we would argue she is raising material breach. The court acknowledges that may be a different issue. She says, correct. But then the court redirects her to talk about the statute again. So even though they proceed to continue to talk about the statute, it does not mean it was not raised. And the interesting thing about that is... later in the transcript, the court specifically says, when it's making a decision on this issue, it specifically says, and this is 124, so to the extent that Ms. Lawson was attempting, in essence, to move to strike or otherwise impose some legal or procedural bar to the petition filed by Mr. Lawson to terminate spousal support, that is denied. Now, I would argue that statement by the court is not a narrow statement saying this is only if 20-109A applies. It is a broad statement which acknowledged the proceeding before or the conversation before that she raised. This is
but a material... As I recall, the trial court bent over backwards to try to understand exactly what the defense was that was being asserted by Ms. Lawson. And after a lengthy exchange, she said she used the term unconscionability. Which is the term from the statute. It seems like that's what Ms. Lawson was directing the court to. That's what the court understood her to be arguing. And so that's what the basis of the ruling was. The first the breach was never asserted as such, was never called to the court's attention. It looked like the whole dialogue was on unconscionability.
Well, I think there's... The direct answer is I think she did raise it, and there's a later part when they come back in April where she also directly raises it again. But before I get to that part, I'd like to take a minute to dive into the weeds, if you don't mind, about whether 20-109A should have applied, because it's complicated. Mr. Pincus painted this picture of, oh, it's very clear that because this is a contractual agreement between the parties, 20-109A does not apply. However, in Hardesty, this court made an en banc decision where it specifically said, even when there is an agreement, to abrogate the effect of a statute requires express language in that agreement. So had Ms. Lawson been able to raise Hardesty and say, well, based on this, and the wording of the agreement itself has this language that says, spousal support shall be terminated for a relationship analogous to marriage. But that on its own might not, and that would be the difference of express versus implied, of did it apply to the language in 109A about unconscionability. However, I would acknowledge, and this is one of the reasons I did not pursue this issue, in Baldwin, this court clarified this issue a year later, and this court says, well, before we can have express language operate, or before we make this decision of whether express language needs to be in the contract to prevent a statute from applying, the statute has to apply first. And so then, if you go back to this case law that Mr. Peterson is relying on, we'd say, it'd say, well, based on this other case law, the statute did not apply, so therefore it did not need to be expressly prevented, as the court said in Hardesty. So the reason why I took the second to raise that complicated issue is because I think the court was having somewhat of a discussion about this unconscionability. But the unconscionability is an issue that is directed in Baldwin so in Baldwin, after it says this, 20-109 doesn't apply, so it needs, so whether or not it was expressly barred by the agreement, the Baldwin court then states that ordinary principles of contract law do apply and determine the scope of that particular agreement. So that is where I say, so even on the first part where we brought it up, but then when she comes back to court, so that in March was when this discussion took place. When she comes back to court, this is 210 of the transcript, the judge said, do you wish to make any argument as to why the motion should not be granted, the motion to terminate support? And Ms. Lawson says, yes, Your Honor, I guess I can't submit anything, but I wonder if you can also look at the numerous times that Joe was in contempt of court and the numerous amount of arrears that he owed me. And then if we skip a few lines down to her response on 13, or on line 14, she says, you can see how many times he has been in contempt of court and pretty much joked the court by being in contempt and hasn't kept up his end of the bargain. And I think that language by someone who is not accustomed to making legal arguments is her saying, especially end of the bargain, she's saying he's in contempt because he hasn't paid. That is her making her best chance at saying he's the first material breach of the party.
Isn't it a fair reading of the record that the court attempted to address that concern that she raised by giving her a judgment for the deficiency?
Well, and that's that was my actual next response as far as the court's judgment, which this, I think, goes more to good cause. But the court's judgment states, and that's in his order, he says, this court takes note of appellant's exceptions noted at the hearing, and her endorsement of this order is hereby waived under Rule 13 of the Supreme Court rules. So I think, again, he is bending over backwards, like he said, and he's bending over backwards to say she is raising another issue here, and it's not just the statute. Now, I think in Hamad,
what she was raising before Judge Mahan also be consistent with just trying to argue essentially unclean hands?
Well, I think that's a good point, Your Honor. She might be trying to argue unclean hands, but unclean hands is also a contractual argument. So then,
but isn't that why we as an appellate court need specificity and an objection to determine what it is that was before the trial court, so the trial court could, number one, intelligently rule, and then we can rule on what the trial court determined?
Well, I'm not too certain that unclean hands is a different argument in itself. It might be unclean hands is an affirmative defense, whereas the argument, I think when Ms. Lawson is specifically responding to the judge saying, is there any reason, I think she's saying, well, this is prevented. He can't assert this because he was in contempt of court so many times. So I think what she's making is not an affirmative defense. She's trying to say he's the material breaching party. But even if that was unclear, that's when I would get to the good cause part of the argument. And I think in Flanagan, this court's, and that's Flanagan versus Commonwealth, is not cited in my brief, so the site is 58 Virginia Appellate 681. This court says the good cause exception is applied when an appellant does not have the opportunity to object to an alleged error during the proceedings below.
But tell us where in the record that she didn't, that the trial court didn't give her an opportunity to object.
I think that would be in the court's final order. She doesn't have an opportunity to voice her objection, specifically that this breach, that the breach is what...
She couldn't file a motion to reconsider, a motion to rehear.
Well, Your Honor, that is actually a very interesting point, because I was retained by...
Because that's why I brought it up.
I was retained by Ms. Lawson after 21 days had expired in June. And the very first thing, we actually had another hearing before Judge Mahan. And the very first thing I did was I brought up Judge Mahan. I said, we'd like to file a motion to reconsider on this issue. And I wasn't sure if based on this order, he was going to say this was a final order or not, because I thought it was maybe questionable because they were going to come back on this arrears issues. And I thought maybe this isn't a final order and maybe we can file a motion to reconsider. And what Judge Mahan said is, I will consider anything you file. So if you file one, I will consider it. However, it's my opinion this is a final order and 21 days has expired. So therefore, we did not file a motion to reconsider. So then it's whether Ms. Lawson knew enough to file a motion to reconsider. But I will say that I'm not certain that Ms. Lawson actually got a copy of this order, because I didn't get a copy of this order until I got it from Mr. Pincus. Ms. Lawson did not have it in her files. Now, her files, admittedly, were not organized and not kept well, so it's possible she did get it. But I think it's also possible this court entered this order, she did not get a copy of it, and 21 days expired, so there was no way for us to make that motion to reconsider, which we would have loved to do.
And the fact that the judge allowed her signature to be waived under the statute, he was doing her a favor, wasn't he? So that everything she'd said was preserved.
I believe that's what he thought he was doing. He believed he was giving her the opportunity to file an appeal to the issues that she raised. And I do not believe that Judge Mahan thought he was limiting her to her argument of 20-109A. I think Judge Mahan did bend over backwards because she was a pro se to try to flesh out these arguments. I think he was more trying to get to the unconscionability of 109A as well. And I do think... I would say researching a lot of this case law, I was surprised to find that no one's raised a material, at least I could not find a cited case where someone actually raised a material breach to prevent someone from terminating spousal support. Because you would think it would be out there, and the only thing that I can say is I think we get mired in the weeds with, well, we have a contempt process for that. And so that's not normal. Normally when a contract goes before the court is considering a first material breach because someone's trying to say, these are my damages because you breached, and this is the action I want. But because we have contempt proceedings, I'd like to actually reserve the last 3 minutes if I could.
I have a question before you sit down. On page 2, where you show assignments of error, and under the rules you're supposed to show where the matter was preserved, you gave several page references, none of which preserve either of those issues. Do you agree with that?
I thought that my paved reference, one of them was between 99, 100, and 124.
No, it was 124 to 126 and 292 to 293.
So 124 would be that motion to strike part that I was referring to earlier, and I had only couched that motion to strike with her raising before he had raised that broad legal bar language.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Morgan?
Thank you. I guess it's still technically morning, Your Honors. Mary Morgan on behalf of the appellee, Joseph Lawson. I think if Your Honors reviewed the appendix, you will note that I was not trial counsel in this matter, which is fairly common and for good reason. But I mention that at this juncture because not having been the trial attorney in this case, I think it gives me kind of a better overview of what happened. And as you know, the argument is that on the appellant side that she raised this issue, and we contest that. We say it wasn't raised.
Let me ask you this, and I was reading between the lines. I thought it was a guts ball approach to rely solely on 5A18 in this matter. Is that to say that you would have to agree that if first to breach had been raised as a defense, it could have been a viable defense in this case?
No, Your Honor. Actually, I was going to talk about that in a moment, but I'll discuss it now. I think, Weinberg has said, you know, we've tacitly agreed to that. We have not. I disagree with that proposition. I felt like when you say, oh, you know, we don't believe it was raised, but in case you do, I think that's kind of hedging your bets and kind of, you know, I don't think that's the proper approach. But here's the analysis of it. As a contract matter, domestic relations separation agreements are typically not viewed as the same type of contract as real estate cases, construction cases, goods and sales. That's why there's no case law out there.
But that's not what the case law says.
I agree that that's true, but I think that that's kind of a understanding because of what Mr. Weinberg raised, and that is the fact that there are procedures in place to alleviate some of the issues that arise in trial courts in domestic relations settings. Okay, first of all, the trial court retains jurisdiction over domestic relations matters, over spousal support, child custody issues. You don't find that in a typical contract case. But you also have this mechanism for dealing with issues as a show cause. You don't have that in a contract case. If I sold you 1,000 widgets and I didn't provide them, you're not going to file a show cause. You're going to file a breach of contract action. So I don't think it's seen as that type of thing. Second, what this court has said on this particular issue, on the material breach, is that the Virginia Supreme Court has said this, is that a material breach is a failure to do something that is so fundamental to the contract that the failure to perform the obligation defeats an essential purpose of the contract. That's Countryside Orthopedics versus Payton, case 261, Virginia 142. So even if that had been raised, she would have had to shown that it was such a fundamental thing. And what I would tender to the court is that there had been a number of breaches on both sides of this case. This is not before the court, obviously. But that's to say we do not waive that argument. We don't think that we waived it by not addressing it. We simply don't think that Ms. Lawson raised it sufficiently with the court at the time.
In this particular case, if I recall correctly, Ms. Lawson was suggesting that this was a fundamental breach of the contract because it was the lack of finances that would do her that caused her to have to live in a relationship analogous to marriage.
That was essentially her argument, in defending on the actual facts of the case. That is correct, Your Honor. So one of the things I want to bring up is that this case came up from the Domestic Relations District Court in actually two cases. Now, Mr. Weinberg has referenced the fact that the termination decision came up, but there was a long diatribe about both cases coming up. One was the contempt proceeding, and the other was the termination of spousal support. That's important because that's the context in which the court was looking at it. Mr. Pincus disagreed that both had been properly appealed, but Judge Mahan was looking at this case like saying, okay, there's a termination of spousal support case, but there's also this contempt proceedings that were both appealed by Ms. Lawson. That's why there was a discussion.
Were those heard along separately at the trial level?
They were heard in the sense that he did tell her that's a separate argument. And that's what you see on occasion is she keeps trying to raise the contempt issue. They're saying that was because she wanted to argue that it was a material breach. But in reality, she's raising that issue because she's also appealed the contempt finding because she did not agree with the juvenile domestic relations district court's calculation of what she believed she was owed from Mr. Lawson.
And so isn't that exactly why specificity of objections is important?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I think this court has said that trial courts deserve to have the contested issues framed clearly and precisely. Only then can a trial court respond to a particular argument and either make a corrective action or with a clarification that would make an appeal wholly unnecessary. That's the whole basis, and that's why I went to this court and said, you cannot just raise this issue for the first time on appeal.
And I will ask Mr. Weinberg this specific question as well, and he returns for rebuttal. Is there anything in the record to suggest that Judge Mahan did not give Ms. Lawson an opportunity to make a specific objection during the course of the trial?
I don't think there is. I think, like this court has recognized, he bent over backwards, and I went to great length to describe those conversations. She went around and around several times, back and forth with the court, and he said, do you have anything else? Do you wish to present anything else? Do you have any other arguments? I mean, she took it upon herself to come into court as a pro se litigant, and he did what he could to try to draw out of her the information that he needed to make a ruling that was clear and precise on the record. But the fact that she's a pro se litigant, the Supreme Court has also said that that doesn't put them on different ground. They still must follow the substantive and procedural law of the case and of Virginia. That doesn't give them an added benefit. So you, Your Honor, Judge Atlee, you had noted some points in the record with, that, you know, talking about Mr. Weinberg saying, okay, this is where it is. Well, one of the things that caught my attention was when they noted the appeal, it was a 24-page range that was cited as referencing this fact, but nowhere within that page range did you actually see a discussion about a material breach. Now, granted, she's pro se, but, you know, after going back and forth, what I really came to the conclusion about was that if that argument had been raised, you would have expected to see a response by Mr. Pincus on that issue. Okay, Mr. Pincus is an experienced trial attorney, and Judge Mahan is an experienced jurist. If they thought this issue had been raised, and even if Mr. Pincus didn't catch it, the court would have directed Mr. Pincus to respond to that argument by saying, well, Mr. Pincus, I think she's trying to say that there's been a material breach. What do you say on that regard? There is nothing along those lines. I think it's safe to say that the fundamental reason of Rule 5A18 is to ensure that both the court and both parties in a case have the opportunity to be heard on an issue when it is at the time that it's most appropriate, at the trial court level, not for the first time on appeal. The language that the appellant has referenced in page 124, I want to talk about that for just a moment, that language on 124 came at the conclusion of Mr. Lawson's evidence on whether or not spousal support should be terminated. Essentially, he took it as a motion to strike, even though she didn't really make that terms, but that's essentially what she said. It came on the heels of a discussion on page 123 between the court and Ms. Lawson where she's discussing the contempt findings. She didn't discuss contempt in a contractual way. She discussed it as being part of her overall case. And he said that's a separate issue because he had not heard from her on the issue that was also appealed to the court, which was the, you know, her disagreement over the calculation of child support. So, I mean, I think his exact language was that the contempt proceedings were separate and apart from the validity of the agreement. So clearly the court did not recognize that Mrs. Lawson may have been trying to argue that Mr. Lawson had committed a material breach sufficient that he should be precluded from terminating spousal support under the agreement. And if the court had recognized that that's what she was trying to do, it would have then amplified its ruling on that issue, but it didn't do that. So again, you know, just going back to the application of contract law, I don't think we concede that issue. I'm of the opinion that, you know, raising that argument just here doesn't preclude us from arguing overall. If this court thinks that it was sufficiently raised, it can remand it to the court, have the discussion there. But I don't think that not arguing it in our brief was anything tantamount to waiving the issue. I think that's all I have, Your Honor. I think it's pretty simple from our standpoint. So it's either there or it's not. And we would argue that it's not. And we would ask this court to dismiss the appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Weinberg, same question. Is there anything in the record to suggest that Judge Mahan didn't give her an opportunity during the course of the trial to object with any degree of specificity?
Sure. I mean, I think this goes back to the provision I was on. When they come back in April and the court asks her, do you want to make any other argument as to why this motion to terminate should not be granted? And she's talking about this contempt issue. She keeps talking about that he's been in contempt, pretty much jokes the court, hasn't kept up with his end of the bargain. And then she talks about how this has led, this contempt directly has led to why this relationship analogous to marriage is, she's kind of forced into it, that the court's now giving great weight to this cohabitation part of that analysis. Well, Mr. Pincus on 212 then says, I'm going to object. So she's trying to bring up these other contempt hearings from prior hearings. Mr. Pincus says, I'm going to object to anything that has to do with another proceeding that she may have filed to the extent that it's not relevant to what we are doing today.
That's an admissibility argument, isn't it?
That was an admissibility argument. This is where I want to get back to with, I think at this point we should be looking under the lens of good cause, and I think whether or not this could be raised. And as the appellee's counsel elegantly highlighted, there were two cases before the court. One of those was the contempt issue. And so the court is constantly looking at this the entire time as the contempt is over here, and the motion to terminate is over here.
Did those two actions have separate action numbers in the?
I believe they did have separate action numbers. However, the order applied to both. So the order did apply to both. The reason I think that is important is because that is exactly what we're arguing, is that the court is used to, both the court and the law is used to dealing with contempt as its own issue and not as a breach of contract. But we have this pseudo-law created by the court that says we have to look at it as contract. So I would argue we have to look at it that way here, too. Thank you, Your Honors.
That concludes the docket. We'll step down and greet counsel.